From RTE Radio, I'm Neil O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
There must be a danger involved, though, is if some, you don't encourage people to go around and start eating the hedges.
We have iconic Irish sports commentary clips on the wall, and the biggest of the lot of them is Jimmy McGee. Different class, different class, different class.
And as soon as we disembarked our vehicles and went in, they started lobbing shells at us.
Coming up on this edition of Playback Daily, the brave filmmaker documenting the lives of Ukrainians during wartime. It's spring, allegedly, so time to get outdoors. And goal! The finest sports commentators from around the world. That's all on the way over the next hour of the Radio Catch-Up Show's Radio Catch-Up Show. The musings on the news, or newsings, if you will, on this morning's Ryan Tuberty Show, presented today by Oliver Callan, started with the fallout over who leaked the details of the upcoming visit of US President Joe Biden.
Yeah, I'm beginning to feel that our annual St. Patrick's ceremony at the White House is now cursed. You had Micheál Martin spending it across the road on Pennsylvania Avenue with COVID last year, last minute disaster for him. And he put a brave face on it as he beamed out of a little telly wheel beside Joe Biden in the Oval Office. And so the big news we were going to be hearing on Patrick's Day on Friday this week was that the president is coming to Ireland, and that was going to be unveiled, I presume, during the Shamrock the ceremony. But no, that's been ruined by none other than the British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, who invited Biden to Northern Ireland. And if you heard the clip in Morning Ireland, Biden's kind of accepting it, but also mumbling as an aside that he's also going south, going, let's go to Republic as well. And I'd imagine they might be hopping mad in the Taoiseach's office and the Department of Foreign Affairs after all the work that they do to make it happen and keeping it under wraps. How we managed to keep Secret Service people going around Mayo and Belfast and Dublin, you know, how do they sneak in? Do they put on a Jimmy Kimmel Irish accent or something? Just, you know. But they did. And until Rishi Sunak said, no, no, you're coming to Northern Ireland. So there, he's the man who shows up basically outside someone's house just as they're arriving unawares to a surprise birthday party carrying a present. Sorry about that. But anyway, in the Irish Independent, Senan Maloney in the Indo was telling us that it's going to be a 5-day visit. Very, very big visit in the scale of US presidents. We don't get many of them. So 3 days in Mayo, he reckons. One in Belfast, one in Dublin. Obviously, you're hearing the Cooley people in Louth talking about, no, he's coming, which he did. He went to Louth and Mayo when he arrived as vice president in 2016. There's a picture of Joe Biden in 2016, looking pretty much exactly as he does now, to be fair. And Enda Kenny's giving me a hurley stick. And it really looks like bygone days. You see, Enda Kenny is Taoiseach. There's an old stick for you, Joe, come along to me, oh. And there is talk here. Senna says there will be a promised game of golf in Castlebar, County Mayo, could also be in the cards with former Taoiseach Enda Kenny, with whom he's built up a strong friendship. So now that you've got Ballina versus Castlebar in Mayo. And not only that, but when he goes west, there is also going to be a competition between which airport Air Force One flies into. Will it be Shannon Airport, where they already have 65,000 US troops go through it annually, because it's kind of a semi-military airport at this stage. Or will he go to Ireland West Airport, colloquially known as Knock Airport? Do not call it Knock Airport when you're talking to an Ireland West Airport worker, executive. Anyway, that's all happening there. And it kind of brings to mind, you know, that these are rare things for us US presidents. Bill Clinton, he came as president 3 times. Officially, only one of those visits was a state visit, where they go for dinner in white tie with the president and so on, the president of Ireland and the president of America, 2 heads of state. Bush, as we know, he didn't come at all on a state visit. I think he stayed in a hotel, and he was part of a G8 or something and looked out the window. Obama came, spent less than a day here, didn't sleep overnight. Trump obviously didn't come. He was only half invited. So it's going to be a big deal. Because it may not happen again for a very, very, very long time. And it's a great consolation for the people of Mayo after they failed to return an Oscar for us at the weekend. A result, let's face it, we personally hold them responsible for as a nation. I think I speak for absolutely everybody there, okay?
The Mayo curse is the gift that keeps on giving. Will it stop Joe Biden from visiting the county? Maybe we should ask Rishi Sunak. Meanwhile, Cork has a litter problem.
The Evening Echo down in Cork City are telling us that there's a new part of the daily litter problem in the city, and it's finding its way into the River Lee and in the drains. Batteries, lithium ion batteries, Why are people throwing these things away? The single-use vape products, you know, these things, they're not being disposed of correctly. City resident Chris Moody, who's involved in cleanup projects in his local area, he finds them in the River Bride, he says, as well as in drain culverts. And in one incident, he found 50 single-use vape products discarded into the river. And it's a big bugbear of his, getting out of control. He sees, he says, and there's no solution. We need someone to come up with solutions, basically. So batteries are a big problem, obviously, because they're going to leak acid eventually and destroy the wildlife and the water supply and all of that. Chris Moody said he's found car batteries, AA batteries in the river, just people just flinging them in, whole electric scooters. And up by the Glen Park, he once came across a motorbike in the river. Someone dumped a motorbike in the river. We have a bad cultural difficulty with littering bizarre things in the country. How do we solve it? Who knows? We don't know.
A bit of a defeatist conclusion to that tale of battery dumping in Cork now. Must do better. Oh, hey, remember COVID?
The journal.ie tells us that the HSE is launching a big survey. They're trying to measure the prevalence of long COVID in Ireland. Now, specifically, they're going to Longford, Westmeath, Laois, Offaly, Kildare, West Wicklow and South Dublin. And they're going to invite people to take part in the survey. It's going to be anonymous. I'm not looking for all your details or anything like that. So never send your details. They're going to receive a text message first and then a text with a link to information about the survey. And you can follow that survey. It'll be very helpful to them because we're told that 21,000 people couldn't work last year because of long COVID symptoms, fatigue and other respiratory issues. And people need to act to look after their needs, I suppose. It's called the FODA survey. So look out for that on the text message, which will come from the HSE. But don't give your details, as you know, at this stage with all the fraud that's going around the place.
Send what you can, but don't leave yourself short. I feel like that would be a better, more Irish way to approach scamming. Or you could just go around the UK eating your way to 10 grand.
Now, if you're a fan of Cadbury cream eggs and Cadbury products in general, you might have noticed they have this huge competition running at the minute where they've hidden 280 half white chocolate, half milk chocolate versions of the cream egg. And it seems to be across UK stores here in the London Independent. I don't know if it's happening over here. But if you find one of these mixed eggs, half white chocolate, half milk chocolate, you can hold on to the egg and claim a £10,000 sterling prize. So unfortunately, a young fella called Adam Davis, he's a YouTuber, so he videos everything he does, and he was in a van going around the place, and he picked up a cream egg and says, "Hi everyone, I'm going to have a cream egg," and he eats a cream egg, and a lot of people are kind of getting in touch with him going, "That was a very strange coloured cream egg," until people obviously started talking about it and went, "That's one of the £10,000 cream eggs. What, you didn't eat the whole thing, did you?" And he went, "Yes, I didn't notice it. I didn't notice any difference in the taste. I was just hungry at the time. I've eaten £10,000 worth of an egg." He can't claim it. It's gone. And but now the young fella is sort of saying, "I don't feel too bad about eating it anymore." I mean, who else can say they ate 10 grand in 30 seconds? Money comes and goes. But a story of an epic fail lasts a lifetime. He's dedicated to the YouTube language, in fairness. Epic fail. But now he's quietly calling on the chocolate giant Cadbury to fork out some of the prize money as a consolation prize. Because he's saying, well, they've got one less egg they have to pay out for. Can they give us a few quid? I have video evidence. It remains to be seen, isn't it? Oh, dear. Not very clever. It doesn't look, it's YouTubing, looking at the camera, not observing, not looking around and taking due care.
Always pay due care and attention when you're eating your chocolate egg. That's my motto. Look, what the hell are you eating chocolate on YouTube for anyway? Who wants to watch you doing that? Try doing your own stunts like Tom Cruise.
Tom Cruise is in the media at the moment. What's he up to? Well, the never-ending Mission Impossible thing, which they must be up to 7 movies at this stage. And actually, he's making 2 movies. Well, he's making one movie that's been split into 2. Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning, part 1. That's done, although it's now 3 hours long and the movie release has been delayed because they're cutting it down. And meanwhile, he's off shooting Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning, part 2. And so he wanted to just gently have a gentle day's filming in the beautiful island of Svalbard, or sorry, the Norwegian territory of Svalbard. It's more of a peninsula. 600 miles from the North Pole. Famous area, actually, Svalbard, because it has a human population of 2,500 and a polar bear population of 3,000. So you can imagine, very important ecological site. And so they just wanted to have a gentle day Mission Impossible filming, which would require 30 helicopter landings on a single day. And the local mayor says, no, you can't do that. The polar bears are more important than Tom Cruise. Well, it's not happening. Good luck. And it has actually become a Mission Impossible filming problem because, well, they've got this tiny window of daylight this time of the year to shoot up there while it's still frozen. So it's a bit of a problem. If anyone saw a lesser spotted BBC series called The North Water, starring Colin Farrell as the most hideous villain you've ever seen on screen. They shot up there in Svalbard and they really got into the water and they really shot walking around on real icebergs. And they got permission because they were very nice about it and they used an old whaling ship from the 19th century. Die Another Day, 2002 Bond film from the very forgettable Pierce Brosnan era of James Bond. GoldenEye was okay. I don't remember any of the other ones. They were just really, really bad CGI is what I remember. But anyway, Mission Impossible told, get the hell out. You're not coming here. You won't get away with that around here, is what they said to him in a Norwegian accent.
You mean Tom now can't run at high speed along the ice and jump onto the leg of a burning helicopter all while nursing a broken pelvis? Lousy polar bears. And speaking of delicate ecosystems,
Skellig Vihil has been chosen as a major site for a climate change study. It's been chosen of only one of 10 sites globally and the only one in the whole of Europe as a focus of a research project on climate change and its worsening effects on heritage. So it's been chosen, the OPW managed site, according to RTE.ie. It's been topped by the Beehive St. Fionnán's Monastery, valued for its bird colony. So they're going to be just looking at the effect of climate change on them birds and on the rocks and stones of Skellig Vihil. And that having a look at what's happening out there. And this is how the scientists who then do their research and present it to the world. And then people go, no, I don't believe your science. Why don't you believe it? I've been sitting on the internet. I've spent many hours on the internet eating cream eggs. And I've discovered that science is like not real at all. And the climate thing isn't happening. No, but I'm a scientist. I've literally been at Skellig V. We've done the study all around the world. No, I've read this thing. So Ron DeSantis said it. He said it in a funny way. And you're all liars. So good luck, scientists. We salute you. But trawling through the Facebook stuff is going to be tough.
Science versus the internet. It's never pretty. Let's bail out of the newsings from this morning's Ryan Tuberty show right there before someone mentions Elon and it all goes to shit. The EU has decreed that new buildings from 2028 will need to have heating and cooling systems that produce zero emissions. Existing residential buildings will need to meet minimum E ratings by 2030. How much will all this cost and how will it affect us? To answer these questions, Claire Byrne was joined this morning by architect Roisin Murphy.
We're talking about zero emissions on new buildings. What does that mean in terms of the kind of systems that we're talking about putting in place to achieve that?
Well, I suppose it's a three-pronged approach, and I sound like a politician now when I'm saying this, but essentially speaking, when we're talking about decarbonising building stock, what we're basically talking about is increasing the insulation in buildings so that they can work with, say, a low-energy heating model like, you know, air-to-water heat pumps and such things and increased solar and wind and hydro and tidal energy. So it's kind of, you're looking for a kind of a neutral power supply to heat the house and insulation in the building stock sufficient that whatever heat you are making, you're retaining and then ventilating the buildings.
And a lot of people listening will be interested to hear what's happening around the rules for existing residential buildings. And just to reiterate that, they're going to have to meet this minimum E rating by 2030. Now, for you, do you think that's ambitious enough?
I think we have to do it. We don't have a choice. It's being rolled out in other European countries. It is a kind of, I would say, we're looking at stepped approaches. They're going to want us up at C soon, like in Scotland, but they'll start off at E. So, but we have a huge amount of single occupied houses in Ireland, if you know what I mean. So we all have different models of living across Europe, there will be a lot of people who live in apartments. There were a lot of people of multifamily dwellings in very large apartments. But we in Ireland have a large building stock of single occupancy. We have a lot of houses, people living in houses as opposed to apartment blocks. Mm-hmm. So we will have a different kind of methodology of how we roll that out. Now, we're quite good at this. We are really trying very hard, and there is indications that we are definitely shifting in the housing stock that we have, especially in the new builds.
Yeah, but for the people in older houses, Roisin, this is going to be a problem 100%. To try and reach even B or of E.
It's not, well, okay, I think the last time we spoke about this was about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, and I definitely think there was a problem then. Because I think that it was so expensive. Well, we were looking at, minimum 25,000 to retrofit your house to do that kind of work. But with the energy crisis, what is sure as night following day is the cost of retrofitting your house is suddenly pale in comparison to the cost of your energy bills. So people's, and there is the thing where we always recommend, and if you go onto the SEAI website, you'll see that you can do this in bits and pieces. Now, there's several ways in which you can do it. You can wrap your building in insulation. You can do it from the inside. You can do it from the top down. But insulation, it can be applied kind of in a stage manner throughout your home, and there are grants available. The problem is, and I think this is where, even in reference to your previous guest, is where we have a rented accommodation, where we have people who are far more vulnerable on the housing chain as such. And we're seeing across Europe that landlords are being forced to bring their, because they're really targeting the worst buildings across. I mean, they're going to target the leaky ladies as such in terms of energy. So the problem will be in rental accommodation and protecting vulnerable people from bearing the cost of that retrofit, and to protect them from being evicted.
Yeah. Going back to the grants, though, I know that they have been ramped up. They're more accessible for some people. Yeah. But the point still remains, you still have to speculate your own cash in order to get those grants, unless you're in a very particular category.
I agree.
Some people just can't afford to do it.
Oh, no, it's really difficult. It's really, really, really difficult. But the thing is, we're not going to have any options on buying into this, because we're going to have these things, the EPC certificates. They're talking about how they're going to implement these. It may be a point of sale to enforce the upgrading. So say if you're buying or selling a house at the moment, say if you're buying or selling an apartment, the purchaser of that apartment has to meet fire regs at the moment. You know what I mean? Say if you're buying an apartment in the old scheme, you have to, before you buy that apartment, you have to show legally that it meets current fire reg standards.
Yes.
Okay, so you may have to. That's what's going to happen really in retrofitting, where they're going to force people in at targeting at certain points to make them comply with the regulations. So if somebody is selling a house, the purchaser will have to show that they can buy it. But I do think one of the problems is that it's also where we may have real difficulty, I think, is in actually supporting homeowners and actually getting people around to do this. There's a shortage of workers, really. And all builders will say this to you, in getting people on site at the moment is difficult, because the larger building projects are mopping up an awful lot of what would usually have been the labour force that was, kind of wandering around. And that, so it's a very important that the government accepts and understands how difficult this is going to be to implement for homeowners.
Architect Roisin Murphy talking to Claire Byrne this morning about new EU regulations on heating and cooling buildings. On this afternoon's Live Line, Joe Duffy spoke to John, a member of the travelling community who wants to be an electrician, but he can't get an apprenticeship.
John, you want to become an electrician?
Correct.
Okay, correct. So what's the barrier at the moment?
The barrier basically is you need 5 passes in the junior cert.
Okay.
I wasn't allowed to sit any more than 4 subjects at the time.
Okay. Now, why was that?
I had lots. I don't know, Joe. I don't know. My mum and I never questioned it, really. I'd lost my dad a few years previous to sitting the junior cert. And I just... everything, the life kind of died within me.
Okay, but you got four subjects in your junior cert. You did four, and you got four.
I did four, and I got four. Yeah.
Well, that's great in itself. And did you like? I don't know whether you were moving in those times, but like, did you go to school? Did you attend four, second and third year in second level school?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I concluded in the town where I lived. I was in the primary school. Primary school, and then I went into the local secondary school. I did the first year, second year, third year. I was the only traveller within my class.
Mm-hmm. What was that like, John?
It was tough.
In what way?
I definitely felt it. Well, everyone in the class knew that I came from a different community.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to show them that I was just like them, and I was no way dangerous to them or anything like that.
And had you got any friends in the class?
Oh, I had, yeah. I had friends within the settler community that was in the class with me as well.
Yeah, great.
But there was times like I would have got some abuse off them as well. But again, because I'd want to feel part of it, I wouldn't really pay attention to it. You know, I wouldn't turn it into an argument. I'd want to be friends with them, you understand?
Okay. So now you're basically contacted us because you want to become an electrician, but you need an apprenticeship. To get an apprenticeship, there are two ways. One is you get five, you begin with, you're not guaranteed. Unfortunately, the number of apprenticeships, the low number of apprenticeships in Ireland is scandalous, absolutely scandalous. We should be, and people talk about why we aren't building houses, because we don't have people who can build houses, it seems. We don't have enough electricians, enough carpenters, enough block layers, enough plumbers, enough roofers, because the whole apprenticeship system effectively collapsed during the austerity years, as they call it. And now everyone who's saying we need to build more houses, which is everyone, not one of them, including myself, can put a nail in the wall. You know what I mean? So we need people like you who want to be electricians. So what you need is an employer to say, I will take you on and I will guide you. You need an electrical company to say we're willing to give you. You're 32 years of age. Now, what have you done so far to try and get that connection, that network?
I'm 36, Joe. Sorry, I'm 36.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry.
Talking to me puts years on everybody, John. Don't be worried. Okay, you're 36.
I'm 36. I've worked in the construction industry.
Okay.
For the last number of years. So I would have worked closely with electricians, but obviously not working with them. So I would have ran cables for them. I would have put up the plastic sockets that you'd see on the walls.
Okay.
Ran cables to them. Obviously, I wouldn't do any connecting because done by a certified person. I've done clean rooms. I can read drawings.
Okay. And what reaction do you get? Because it sounds like you've incredible going. What reaction do you get when you say it? Do you have to write to companies or do you knock into companies?
I do email. I do look at indeed.ie, and then I can only send a CV through there. I don't feel I'm getting enough information down about the educational side and what I can give to the company. So I do email them off emails explaining that I'm a member of the traveling community in Ireland. And basically, I'm a driven, hardworking chap, you know. I don't mean any harm to anybody. I'm just an
artist. John, you shouldn't even have to say that. We know, God, it's obvious, listen to you. Like, the 99,
well,
you don't mean harm to anybody. Seriously, you sound fantastic. Yeah, you sound... Four children. What age are your children?
My eldest lad is 15.
Okay.
He's doing his junior cert this year.
Brilliant.
Extremely proud of him. Fine young man. Coming out as a traveller, it's never been easy for me.
Mm-hmm.
Just because when I do come out, the experience the experiences I've had is admitting that I am a traveller to people, the experiences haven't been good.
How do you not know?
Any jobs that I'd have in the past, I would never put down I was a traveller. I just apply for it like anyone else would apply for the job. Just because I'd be afraid of this discrimination.
Mm. And what reaction, you know? To use your own phrase, what reaction did you get when you came out as a traveller?
It's been a bit conflicting for myself because there's times where I suffered abuse from the settled community.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also suffered it from my own community because I married a settled girl.
Yeah. And what's the problem?
That can tend to bring its own issues. A lot of traveling people tend to marry traveling people. But that was not for me. I was going to break the mold. Mm-hmm. I was always going to break the mold of that. And the wife I have is fantastic.
Yeah,
absolutely. She's the one that gives me strength that I keep looking for this apprenticeship. I've been looking for it since the age of 30. I started contacting the education system, but I send off CVs and some of them I do admit I'm a traveller, some of them I don't.
Okay.
And I tend to get back stuff when I don't mention I'm a traveller. I tend to get back email saying that they've moved on to the next stage. But if it's a traveller, they tend not to get back any correspondence at all from the company.
That's John, a member of the travelling community, talking to Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Liveline about trying to secure an apprenticeship as an electrician. Anya Murray is an ecologist, broadcaster and former host of RTE TV's Eco Eye. Her book, Wild Embrace, Connecting to the Wonder of Ireland's Natural World, has just been published, and Anya dropped into studio to talk about all things outdoorsy with Oliver Callan.
So I won't call it a campaign, because it's an encouragement to get out and look at what... Because there are people who find themselves shocked and surprised even when it rains, so they don't even check forecasts. There are people so... they don't notice anything going on outside, aren't there? So is that who you're looking to talk to?
I think I'm kind of trying to get at everybody. So even people who are already into the outdoors and have some understanding. But this is about strengthening the connection that we have with nature. And I guess encouraging everybody to find their own little ways, the places that they love to go and go there regularly and learn the changes in the plants and the bird life over the season and really forge a deeper connection with nature.
And you don't have to go far afield.
No, that's a lot of the point of what I'm saying is that you can find somewhere near you. It might be a riverbank. It might be, if we're here, it might be the Dodder. It might be a local woodland or even a park. There's lots of opportunities to connect with nature.
Do you have to kind of turn on the senses that have been shut down by all our smartphones and all of this sort of stuff? Because you can hear the birds, but you sometimes don't listen.
Absolutely. A big part of connecting with nature is putting the phone away, stop nattering, calm the busy mind and start noticing a bit more, just being a bit more open. Even things like the lichens on the bark of a tree can be amazing if you pause and you're that little bit more still and quiet and calm and observe.
And moss, you're a fan of moss.
I am a big fan of moss. Yes, yeah. There was a lot of moss in my college dissertation, and I have been fascinated with them since. But even just look, if you look through a hand lens or a magnifying glass at mosses, the geometrical patterns are really incredible. They're very beautiful. And these are things we walk past every day without thinking about.
A lot of people now are going, no, I have my lawn is gone with the moss. There's just nothing but moss there. And they're shaking your fist at the moss woman on the radio.
Yeah, there is a perception that we like our very manicured, perfect green lawns. And really, when we open up to mow the lawns less, so things like no mow May, whereas we don't mow the lawn during May and we allow a few more wildflowers in, that creates so much more colour and texture and vibrant life.
It looks better, isn't it? I mean, it's a good solution to, if people are sick of looking at the moss, because they cut the moss with the lawnmower and then it just turns white. or if they try to kill it, it just sort of turns black.
Yes.
Like end times.
Yes, at the beginning of COVID, I have an elderly uncle who was always very pristine and correct in how he managed the garden, and I was encouraging him to mow a little bit less, and he was really worried genuinely about what the neighbours might think. But he did this, and then he was ringing me up effusing about all the different bumblebees and the different butterflies that were in the garden, and like he was converted himself.
Yeah,
by observing the changes.
Yeah, purely because of what he had done.
Yeah.
And I've actually seen the garden designs and everything are changing. They're moving away from all the kind of manicured lawns. And you even see moss creations over stones and everything over a long...
That's right.
Kind of cool, isn't it?
And wildflowers as well. And even it's a lot about perception. Even things like dandelions are one of the most important wildflowers for... Like right now, we've got early emerging bumblebees and tortoiseshell butterflies are coming out of their winter hibernation.
We see them already.
Soon, and probably in the next week or so. And they need, like, they've been asleep all winter and they need a good fill of sugary nectar. And what's out there now but dandelions? So you'll see them on the dandelions. And yet we have this instinct to get rid of the dandelions. Yeah. We don't like them, but they're really important for pollinators.
I'm one of the people who kind of, when you see the... what do you call the wind catching seeds when they're on the dandelion later?
That's right.
I kind of grab them, going, no, they're spreading everywhere.
Yeah.
It's a native Irish wildflower, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And there's so many other native, like what we would think of as weeds. And if we switch our perception a little bit, we can see that many of these things have huge value, not just for pollinators, but for us as well. Like, if you know, I love my front garden. It's a complete mess. It's a tangle of whatever kind of makes its way in there. And I love that. It is about perception.
That's a great defence if someone says, well, what is the state of your garden? I'm ecologically minded and I'm letting the moss take over. What else are we looking out for at this time of the year? Willow catkins, what are they?
Willow catkins are, they're the flowers basically on willow trees, and you'll see them, they're bright yellow, they're like little kitten tails.
Yeah.
And they carry this huge amount of pollen. And again, they're really important for early emerging bumblebees and butterflies because pollen is a protein-rich food for them when they come out of their winter slumber. So both hazel and willow have catkins that are full of pollen. And that's what you'll see at this time of year before a lot of the wildflowers are out.
Obviously, the shamrock is growing. Does shamrock exist? What?
I'm laughing at that because we're quite near St. Patrick's Day.
Exactly.
So we have clovers are traditionally our shamrocks. But there's also the species of, there's wood anemone, and they are known as the shamrock as well. They have a shamrock-like leaf and they're a little woodland flower, a white flower
that
comes
wood?
Out. Wood anemone.
Wood anemone.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Wood sorrel. There's wood anemone and wood sorrel.
I can't believe you got that right. Wood sorrel. So that's a great thing to bore people with on St. Patrick's Day. Going, actually, it's not shamrock. It's a wood sorrel.
Yeah.
It's a trifoliate leaf. A clover.
Exactly. Well done, Oliver.
I'm just reading it here. Are nettles coming out? And is this the time of the year?
Nettles are emerging now, and nettles are really important again for lots of different insects. I know we tend to think of them as a weed, but they're also good for us. There's a Cavan tradition of eating nettles three times during Lent to fill up on good nutrients and to cleanse the blood after the winter in preparation
only
for spring.
Only in Cavan.
Well, I've heard of it as a Cavan tradition, three times during Lent.
Oh, right.
But I mean, nettles were like, they're known as spring cabbage as well. Nettles are something that people have eaten for thousands of years. They're really nutritious food.
By the way, nettle soup, you have to put loads of spuds and leeks in it, don't you? Is it more of a garnish?
You can use it like spinach, like that baby spinach. You can use it whichever way you want. I put in a lot of nettles when I make nettle soup.
And it's the one with the white flower, not the stinger.
It's the stinging nettle.
Oh, it's the stinging one.
It's the stinging nettle.
Really?
Yes. The sting goes out of it once you boil it.
Of course, like the antidote for people mightn't realise if they get stung by nettles is the dock leaf.
That's right.
As soon as you crush it up.
That's right. Yeah. And I've got lots in the book. I've got lots of these kind of recipes and ways that people can connect with wildlife, whether through foraging and eating or observing, gathering.
Yeah. And you have to be careful, don't you, when you're foraging? Let's face it.
Yes.
Because I did not know this until I saw it in your book, but... Is it young hawthorn leaves that people used
to eat? That's right. I have a friend who used to walk to school in County Kildare and said that they would eat the hawthorn leaves the whole way along the route. Now, it's the young hawthorn leaves that come out in May. When they're a bit older, like in the summer, they're tougher. But they're quite good. They're tasty enough.
Kind of bright green at the beginning.
Yeah. Fresh, tender hawthorn leaves.
There must be a danger involved, though. You don't encourage people to go around and start eating the hedges.
I don't know of a danger if you know the species and you're eating the right leaves.
Oh, if you know the species?
Yes.
Oh, so yes.
Now, most leaves are pretty edible. Most flowers are edible, but don't eat anything that you don't know what it is. Make sure you've identified it properly first.
Enjoy nature responsibly, folks. That's the message. Anya Murray talking to Oliver Callan this morning about her new book, Wild Embrace, Connecting to the Wonder of Ireland's Natural World, which is published by Hachette Books Ireland. Claire Byrne was joined this morning by RTE Sports Damien O'Mara to talk about sports commentators around the world. And having listened to Argentine commentator Andreas Caster celebrating Argentina's victory in last year's World Cup, they moved to Victor Hugo Morales.
This is back in 1986, Diego Maradona's famous goal, not the one perhaps that comes to mind firstly, the handballs, the other one, against England, 1986. Let's have a listen. Ahí la tiene Maradona, lo marcan dos, pisa la pelota Maradona, arranca por la derecha el genio del fútbol mundial y es el tercero a tocar para Borruchaga siempre Maradona, genio, 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 ta, 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 ta. Sounds like a horse race in the beginning of that.
There's two things about this item. One is the quality of broadcast technology has got an awful lot better because a lot of these clips, you can't quite make out what they're saying. So that's obviously Mexico 86 when Maradona went past every member of the English team on his way to goal. We have the sports department downstairs. We have iconic Irish sports commentary clips on the wall. And the biggest of the lot of them is Jimmy McGee. Different class, different class, different class. So that's obviously, you know, the height of 86 in Mexico. The elongated goal can be traced back to the 40s. So there was a Brazilian commentator, Rebelo Jr., on radio back in the 40s who brought this in. And obviously the fact back then is that sports commentary was such a new discipline on radio. The story goes that he would do a short goal if it was a good chance. And if it was a better chance, it would be a slightly longer goal. Mm-hmm. And then when the goal was eventually scored, he would go on. But you have to imagine how much practice must go into this. Or
lots of time in front of the mirror, can you imagine?
Having the lung capacity ready to go. but I think, you know, the last World Cup, I think, really did something. So maybe, I don't know, was it social media? Was it the novelty of having the World Cup on when it was on? Or just special results along the way? I think it did much more for people buying in or maybe being exposed to the native commentary clips from around the world, because with so many great moments in the last World Cup, which kind of lent their... social media lent it to that.
And that brings us to the next one, which is from a Saudi Arabian commentator, is it?
Yeah, so basically, the last, I think one of the key moments in the last World Cup was Saudi Arabia beat Argentina mm-hmm. on the third day of the World Cup.
Yes.
And we had all bought into this idea that, okay, there were obvious questions about Qatar and their staging of the World Cup, which was all very justified. But the group stages had been changed. And we all thought we had this week of inconsequential games that you could pick each group who was going to advance. And then Saudi Arabia caused the shock of all shocks.
Let's listen to this. We need those defibrillators in the phone boxes at some stage for this.
So obviously the elongated goal has been replaced by the elongated Allah. So the commentary of the clip is like there's multiple chants of Allah, and then it's this is history, this is history, this is history. Mm-hmm. And it's just that unbridled nature of getting completely caught up in the moment of, and you know, that for Saudi Arabia, that was Saudi Arabia's Italia 90 mm-hmm. for us.
Absolutely. Well, we have our own history makers bringing this back home, don't we, when it comes to sports commentary?
Yeah, and we've got quite a unique place in sports commentary as a nation. The first ever match broadcast in Europe was on 2RN. Paddy Meagan, he was known as Carberry. He was a well-known GAA journalist in the print media back in the 20s, broadcast the All-Ireland hurling semi-final between Kilkenny and Galway. The BBC at the time, like the BBC's first soccer commentary was in January 1927. They weren't allowed to do commentaries on the radio up to that because the newspaper industry was such an important part of maybe UK influence that it was felt that if you did live sport on the radio, you would then affect the newspaper sales the following morning because people wouldn't need to buy.
And they had the power, the newspaper industry at the time, to make sure that wasn't happening.
100%. So, first broadcast on 2RN, first match in Europe in 1926, and then first soccer match in England wasn't until 1927. I was kind of conscious going back through the archives, I didn't want to come in and just have loads of clips of Irish commentators. And then you start to step away from it and you go, well, actually, there are areas around the world where we've had significant influence. And like Micheál O'Hare, you know, Grand National commentary, for example, you cannot do an item like this or cannot talk about the Grand National without including Micheál O'Hare.
And this is what we're going to hear now, one of the classic horse racing moments. And this is the voice of Micheál O'Hare.
With Rutherford's along the inside, and Rutherford has been hampered, and so has Castle Falls. Rochetto has fallen, Principal has fallen, Norther has fallen, Curtain Lad has fallen, the Fossa has fallen, there's a right pile up, Leezy has climbed over the fence and left his jockey there, and now with all this mayhem, Fornavon has gone off and he's off. He's about 50, 100 yards in front of everything else.
Now, what we learned from that is that man did his homework.
Oh, this is phenomenal. So this, and again, when The Guardian and the BBC and other outlets compiles the greatest ever sports commentaries, this always features very prominently. So Foinaven was a 100-to-1 shot, wasn't in the reckoning for the Grand National at all. They come to the 23rd race, fence in the race, and literally a third of the field collapses. And all out of a sudden, without even losing breath, as we've heard, Micheál O'Hare kicks into gear with Foinaven. He had told the story time and time again that basically he had this forensic task of remembering the colours of the horses and would start out like weeks, months in advance, and was in the weigh room watching the jockeys come out before the race. And all of a sudden, this black and red combination appeared in front of him that completely stumped him.
That didn't figure in his homework.
Sidles up to the jockey to be told, oh no, this is Foinaven and ran in green previously. The owners didn't fancy the green colours, so we've switched it up today. And like I think that there's, you know, he famously spoke about it on The Late Late Show with Gay Byrne back in the 60s and basically said, well, like, it was prep and this is what you do. But you don't do
it. Making it look easy.
Exactly.
Right?
You don't do it without having the prep. So yeah, the great Micheál O'Hare and probably one of the iconic Grand National moments.
Let's move on then. 10 years after that, 1977, here's Peter O'Sullivan.
Red Rum being preceded only by Loose Horses, being chased by Church Gone Boy. Ike Catchum has moved into third of the Pill Garlic Force. They're coming to the elbow. There's a furlong now between Red Rum and his third Grand National triumph. And he's coming up to the line to win it like a fresh horse in great style. His hat's off and a tremendous reception. You've never heard one like it at Liverpool. Red Rum wins the National.
Peter O'Sullivan, the first sports broadcaster to be knighted in the UK, ending Damien O'Mara's piece on sports commentators around the world on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne. In June last year, Ray Darcy spoke to filmmaker Finn Boylan from Bray, who had travelled to Ukraine to document the lives of those in the middle of war. Ray caught up with Finn again this afternoon.
First of all, remind us about you. You're a documentary maker. What brought you to Ukraine?
I studied history, politics, and I've always been fascinated by that. And I've been deeply fascinated by geopolitics. I mean, like I said to you on your show before, every nation state that exists in the world is a result or an outcome of conflict. And we're chronically aware of that here in Ireland. So I studied film. I was living in Germany and travelled to many hotspots before, including Mali, West Bank, Nagorno-Karabakh, but nothing on the scale of this. And when I've been following this war since 2014. It coincided, the revolution in Maidan coincided with my graduation 2014, so 9 years ago now. And that was kind of like what sparked my interest in this. And I knew then that this conflict already had the potential to upset the long peace that we've enjoyed in Europe for the last 70 years. And I knew then that, you know, that peace is incredibly fragile. And seeing what happened now, I was in a perfect position to document it. I had the camera skills, had the knowledge, I'd been around. And so, yeah, I went for it. And I arrived actually on Sunday now, just gone, is the 1 year anniversary of when I arrived in Ukraine.
So only a couple of weeks after it started?
3 weeks in I arrived, 12th of March. And I hit the ground running. Met an Irish mechanic from Wicklow also. He was a mechanic on a bunch of Irish ambulances that were sent by the HSE out there. Filmed with them, the Irish ambulances evacuating some kids from Kyiv. And then when those ambulances were sent on to forward locations, I decided to head for Kyiv. And I followed the Irish mechanic into the Lion's Den at the end of March. So I was in Kyiv for the last week for the Battle of Kyiv. We came in via the only route that was open, the southwest. And yes, Kyiv was surrounded on three sides at the time. The Russians had stalled basically at the gates, but I didn't know that going in. And I'll never forget getting off the platform. a bit of laughing and joking with Graham, who was the Irish mechanic. He was shadowing two foreign fighters who were going to join up. They were all going to join together. And we were all, you know, enjoying ourselves on the train in. And yeah, when we departed the train at 6 a.m, the ground was shaking with the amount of shelling going on. And coming up the stairs to the checkpoint, police checking my passport and flicking through the pages, looking for the entry stamp, a massive explosion rang out only about 1 kilometre away. A missile had hit the city. I ducked down. I looked at the window that was overlooking the train. I just got off down the platform. And there was tape across the window. And that's the only thing that stopped it from shattering on me. And I remember ducking down with the lads. And I looked up and the policeman was not even flinching. He was just keep scrolling through my passport like another mundane day at work. And that's how quickly you can become desensitized to this. But it gave me two things. It made me realize, you know, I'm not in any immediate danger right now. But it also made me realize that despite having been to hot zones in Mali or Nagorno-Karabakh or West Bank, like, I had never experienced real war before. And yeah, I got it on my camera for the next week. I was out in the front in Irpin, in Bucha for the liberation, and then down in Mykolaiv for the start of the Ukrainian counter-offensive. And then, yeah, went was also this past Christmas, from October to Christmas, filming in the meat grinder that is Bakhmut in Donbass. So in total, I've spent nearly five months in country. And my
so why, just before we carry on, why do you do it? And I know you've outlined you have an interest in geopolitics. You're a documentary maker, but you were putting yourself in danger because you were documenting it at very close quarters. And I've seen some of your footage, and there are explosions happening. So much so that the camera, you know, the camera falls or is shaking or whatever.
Yeah, I came close twice, Ray. At the start of the Ukrainian counteroffensive in May, I was directly targeted for shelling and I barely escaped with my life.
You weren't personally targeted, right?
We arrived in a recently liberated village. It was only liberated 10 days before. It was a command post for the Russian army. And I arrived there with the only way to get out to that recently liberated area was with a press officer. We drove out in my vehicle, a press vehicle, press markings all over it. The town is, village is abandoned. Went into the school, which was the headquarters, and was filming in the school no more than 5 minutes when the first shell came in. We didn't think anything of it immediately. Like, we were more than 10 kilometres behind the front line at that point. So we just thought it was a stray shell. We took cover in a hallway, in a stairwell of a hallway, the most foundationally secure part of the building. And waited 2 minutes, but then the next one came in closer and they were adjusting their fire and each one was getting closer and closer and closer. So it was a very clear day. My theory is there was a drone up in the air and tracked our movement into the village, and as soon as we disembarked our vehicles and went in, they started lobbing shells at us.
Yeah, and you went back for more. So the why question is important.
The why, what motivates me, Ray, is I have so much on my hard drive, so much stories that need to be told. And if I don't finish this, no one's going to tell those stories and they're going to remain on my hard drive and nobody will see them. As so many people trusted me with their pain, their trauma and their story, whether it be the Irish ones that I have, but particularly the Ukrainian ones, you know. And if I don't finish this, you know, I'll have that weight on my shoulder for the rest of my life, and know that I'll never be able to give a platform for those people to share that experience. Because and I just want to be a window for Irish audiences into a conflict that we're so far removed from geographically, but we're far closer to it than many would think. I mean, I've got several characters, Irish characters in my film, two ex-Irish soldiers, an ex-Irish fireman, and a mechanic, like I mentioned in the beginning, and also a Ukrainian soldier whose wife and kids are refugees in a hotel in Leitrim. So all of these stories, you know, bring such a global context of such a huge information, bombardment of information. It focuses down. Yeah.
That's Bray filmmaker Finn Boylan talking about filming a documentary in Ukraine on this afternoon's Ray D'Arcy Show. Dave Spencer and his family live car-free in Ireland. You what, gay? Dave joined Oliver Callan to explain how ditching the car came about and how he and his family managed to survive the mean streets of Dublin without a mechanically propelled vehicle.
It's interesting how interesting people find it, because I don't think it's that interesting anymore, to be honest. But
maybe not to you, but the rest of us are married to our cars.
Yeah, it's funny. I was thinking about it when I was sitting outside there waiting to come in. I think what happens is when you're young, you think when you become a grown-up, you're going to get a car. You know, that's what you do when you're a grown-up. You get a car, and that's what you do. But we had one car, and we were avid cyclists. We had two small kids.
We should say, just I want to start. You're living in Dublin.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have two small kids. What age are your kids?
8 and 10 now.
Okay.
Yeah.
8 and 10. So there's four of you in the family.
Yeah.
And you're doing, working away as normal, and you have a car.
We did have a car initially, because all grown-ups have cars.
So how long have you been without the car?
We've been without the car for about 4 years, maybe.
Okay,
so
very small
maybe.
Children.
Yeah.
Yourself and herself, when you decided, what are you thinking about when you're saying, let's get rid of the car, let's see if we can live here without a car?
To be honest, it's interesting because you had Anya on beforehand talking about nature and things like that. It really began because I was reading things like The Guardian, George Monbiot, who would talk about the end of the world and climate crisis. And I have two small kids now, and I kept thinking, what would they think about how we lived our lives ourselves and how we would change what we did and what were we doing to try and help? So I was always a keen cyclist, and Vanessa was too. So we had one car, and we kind of experimented for about 6 months to try to not use the car at all, but we had it there in the background, and we realised that it was doable. So eventually we sold it because it was just costing us lots of money as well. I didn't really enjoy driving as much as cycling. People get quite angry in cars, and I think I was one of them as well. But so we sold the car for, you know, 400 euros or something, because it was a wreck of a thing, and we bought an electric bike. So Vanessa uses the electric bike to
early
go.
Adopters.
Yeah, they're amazing. They are the key. And also we use go-kart a little bit if we need to go somewhere quite far. But I think
So
we haven't completely stopped driving. No. So maybe we might use a go-kart once a month.
Go-kart is a pay-as-you-go.
It's amazing.
Public service, isn't it?
All over Dublin. They're outside of Dublin. You know, petrol's included. You can get an electric go-kart. I mean, I feel like maybe I should work for go-kart, but I do think they're fantastic. You literally have an app, you click a button, you get a car, you use it for an hour, you know, you drive down to Wicklow, whatever it is, and you come back. But you don't, I got to be honest, if you live in Dublin, you don't really need a car.
So your family business inside Dublin is totally car-free?
Totally car-free.
Have you had to make compromises? I presume, obviously, you've had.
Only if you're going distances. But we use the bus an awful lot, and we cycle. What we find when we tell people we use the bus, a lot of people sort of turn their nose up at it and go, the bus, you know?
Yeah.
As if it's something that, you know, children might use or just other people, but real grown-ups don't use the bus. So
there is a snobbery towards it, but obviously loads and like huge numbers of people in Dublin depend on the bus.
Absolutely. But I must say I've come across that snobbery quite a lot, which is a whole story in itself. But, you know, I was saying to somebody else just earlier, Google Maps is amazing. You can put into Google Maps, you can say, I want to go to, you know, St. Anne's Park and arrive at 11:30. And it'll tell you to leave your house in 4 minutes, walk to the bus, get on the bus into town, hop on another bus, and you get there, and it's amazing.
I'd imagine most people are kind of thinking, I can't do the big weekly shop without a car.
That's the other first thing that people say to me, how do you do the shop? So what we do is we drop the kids to school, and then on the way back we hop into Lidl or Aldi, or, you know, and we get a bag full of groceries, get some kind of cheap stuff, reduce to clear, sustainable, da 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 da. And that's it. And we just do that on a daily basis. It might be sort of like, it kind of feels like something from the old days, but we shop every day, a small bag of groceries every day.
I see. So you're not doing the big weekly shop?
No.
And you're not driving for bits and pieces either. So you're just coming in the bag.
And if you go into the supermarket at 8:30 in the morning, there's nobody there. It's way less stress.
So how are you getting it? Have you got one of those bikes that the kids are in, or are they cycling themselves?
Initially, I had a trailer on the back of my racer. Yeah. A double thing where the two of them were in, which had a cover on it in case it rained. I used to put hot water bottles in there and blankets when it was cold, so I'd be flying around with the two of them and that. And then they started cycling when they were three, the kids. They had balance bikes first. And then we just cycled everywhere with them from that point on. Vanessa has the electric
pouring
bike.
Rain, pouring cold
rain.
Yeah,
we have amazing wet gear, you know. Decathlon has amazing wet gear, so you just put it on in the morning. It's so doable, it's not funny. But it just takes a bit of a mind change, I think, to do it.
I bet it does. That's Dave Spencer telling Oliver Callan this morning how he and his family make do without a car. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, Claire Byrne was joined this morning by singer Lisa McHugh, who performed her new single, I Quit, live in studio.
I quit second guessing putting this two-piece on, judging itty-bitties in a padded bra, fine skinny mockers hold the sugar skipping the croissant. Well, I quit looking in a mirror at my dimple bum, hiding imperfections with a weekly bronze, shopping for the grossest case they know me, but a full face on. Who's all this caring for? I can't take it anymore. Strapping on stilettos and killing my feet, strutting like I didn't get them clearance cheap, taking pretty pictures of food I can't afford to eat. Well, I quit trying to figure out how to measure up, chasing validation I ain't giving a fun Friday night, perfect light to selfies, can we just get drunk? Ooh, I'm gonna stick it to perfection.
Lisa McHugh performing her new single, I Quit, live on Today with Claire Byrne this morning. And that's all I have for you on this edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Shurathon. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE Radio Player. And there'll be another episode of Playback Daily at the same time tomorrow. Probably. Until the next time, thank you for listening and good luck.